In a couple of weeks, he came back and he was very, very pleased with himself because he had got a job, a permanent job, and he was very happy. But he was a very honest man, and he told me, he said, and what was the job? He was a lower division clerk. He'd got a job as a lower division clerk, a permanent job. He was very pleased, and he told me, I have the second best job in this whole village. So I was a bit puzzled. I wanted to know who had the first best job in the village. And he was extremely fair-minded. He said, Gopal, he has a better job than me. That's really better than mine. I knew that Gopal also was a lower division clerk. So I asked him, how is his job better than yours? He said, no, mine is I'm a lower division clerk in the West Bengal government service. He's a lower division clerk in the central government service. And I must concede that. That's superior. So this kind of preoccupation is very much there. Now, I'm not saying that this is going to stay with us forever, but I think that some part of it is going to stay with us, as it has stayed with all modern societies. So that the question that was raised is that, can we do away with inequality? I think it is altogether utopian to think that we can do away with the inequalities that arise from the differentiation and ranking of occupations. We can reduce those inequalities, but I think it is folly to try to do away with all inequalities, even of income, between the this has been tried out. It was tried out in the Soviet Union, and it proved to be a disaster. I am not saying that the present income differentials are the right ones. They can perhaps be reduced substantially. But the belief that when you have a highly differentiated occupational system, you can eliminate all income differences on a permanent basis and create a stable occupational structure in which everybody will have the same income is, I think, a pipe dream. And I don't think that it is a very responsible position to take. Suppose you did manage to achieve that, to level and standardize incomes, you would still not be able to cancel out differences of esteem or status between the neurosurgeon and the janitor. You might want to say that we'll give both of them the same pay. This kind of thing, it has been studied in such great detail in the Soviet Union and in other Eastern European countries that I think that it is one thing to say that we are obsessively preoccupied with distinctions of status, but I think it's a different thing to say that we can have a social arrangement which will do away with all differences of esteem between and among the different occupations. I don't think that is possible, which is not a ground for saying that the prevailing obsession with differences of esteem or status are the right ones, and that we should not worry about this kind of obsessive preoccupation with differences or distinctions of status and esteem. Thirdly, distinctions, differences of power and authority as between different occupations. I don't think that we can do away with this. Let us examine, for instance, the case of the medical profession. I know that we have a very distinguished member of that profession in our audience. But let us look at it in the following way. It is a scandal, and I personally think it is a scandal, the way in which medical practitioners, legal practitioners, architects, and now accountants charge or demand absolutely exorbitant fees. It is a scandal. And you can, therefore, you can work out a whole range of medical practitioners and the differences between the highest earning and the lowest earning, and that difference will be a very, very big one. Many societies, certainly in Britain, in the Netherlands, have thought that this is totally iniquitous and one must do something for the provision of health services without this kind of extreme hierarchy. So you organize medical practitioners in various organizations of the state, and you level out the differences in emoluments between medical practitioners. But then you introduce another kind of distinction. After all, there may be an enormous distinction in terms of income, an enormous difference between the cardiac specialist who has an independent practice and the ordinary GP. But nevertheless, the ordinary GP is still his own master. He is not subordinate in an organizational hierarchy to the person who may be earning 50 times his income. Once you organize people in a formal system, there are bound to come about differences of authority between them. And to the extent that all modern societies depend on organizations of one kind or another, not just bureaucratic organizations within the civil service, but organizations of many different kinds, it is very difficult to see how equal amounts of authority could be assigned to all members within an organization and still keep the organization as a working organization. Therefore, the question that was raised yesterday and the day before yesterday, do not inequalities reappear no matter what we do with the caste system? The answer to that question is definitely yes. But certain things need to be added. These new inequalities are in some very important ways different from the old inequalities. The life chances of individuals under the new system of inequalities are quite different from the life chances of individuals under the old system of inequalities of caste. That is, every individual has some possibility, at least, of moving upwards and some risk of moving downwards. That also has to be kept in mind in the new system of inequality, whereas all of that was frozen in the older system of inequality. Secondly, I think that it is far easier now, at least possible, not to eliminate the distinctions of income, esteem, and authority between the different occupations, but I think it is far easier to regulate, to modify, to mitigate, to soften the inequalities of income, esteem, and authority between the different occupations in a modern occupational system. So that is really all I wanted to say today in the context of class as against caste. Thank you.
I come to the last of my four presentations, and that is on secularism. I must confess straight away that this is a subject in which I feel somewhat out of my depth. It is very different from the topics on which I have been speaking to you for the last 3 days. Those are topics, tribe, caste, class, on which I have spent a considerable amount of time as a sociologist trying to understand from the sociological point of view their various implications and consequences. Secularism, on the other hand, is not a topic on which I have, as a sociologist, spent a very great deal of time. Nevertheless, I thought that it might be useful to bring it up and to discuss it in view of what I described as the somewhat changed intellectual atmosphere in our country over the last 5 or 10 years. And I would like to dwell a little bit on the changes in the intellectual atmosphere in our country in recent years. I think it would be safe to say that during the first 4 decades after independence, articulate intellectuals, intellectuals who spoke at places like this, intellectuals who addressed conferences, public meetings, wrote in the media, wrote professional papers, all spoke in one voice, in favor of, in support of secularism. There was very little attempt at an intellectual position which would state some kind of opposition to secularism. If people had any opposition to secularism, that opposition was muted. There must have been a great deal of indifference to it and a certain amount of opposition to it from outside the intellectual strata of society. But those voices were not heard. There may have been latent opposition to it among intellectuals themselves, but somehow they did not feel that the time was opportune to express their skepticism, their opposition, and sometimes even their hostility to secularism. I must confess that my own bias as a sociologist and as an intellectual, is in favor of secularism. And therefore, I find it particularly important to understand what is it that other persons with the same kind of intellectual equipment and training are trying to say when they raise voices in opposition to secularism. What is it that they are trying to say? Now, I welcome this articulation of a new voice questioning secularism, because I think that it enables people to bring out into the open disagreements on questions that I believe to be of fundamental importance. So that is the main reason why I think that secularism is a topic on which I too would like to make some observations, and I would certainly welcome your questions, your observations, your comments on what I have to say. And I think that unlike on my previous presentations, I would like to make my own preferences, my own biases clear at the very outset. And my own bias and my own preference is for a secular viewpoint or a secular orientation, because I consider a secular orientation, and I shall explain as I go along what I mean by that, I consider a secular orientation as an essential groundwork, as an essential basis for the very method that I apply as a sociologist to the understanding of social phenomena in any society, whether this society or some other society. I'm not saying that the sociological perspective on the world is the only possible perspective. There is a religious, there is a theological perspective, which is rather different from the sociological perspective. But if I am to be a sociologist, if I am to apply a certain approach, a certain method to the understanding of society and its institutions, then I cannot see how that method can be grounded in anything other than a secular orientation. So in a sense, my bias for secularism derives from what I consider to be the very method that is essential for the understanding of society, its structures, its institutions, its contradictions, and its changes. But I have already said a very great deal, and I haven't as yet given any indication of what is it that one means by secularism. And I think some of the trouble with the proponents of secularism is that they have used the notion of secularism in a very promiscuous way. They have used the term secularism to mean all kinds of things. And therefore, those who are critics of secularism have found it relatively easy to point out contradictions in the use of the term and the concept of secularism. I personally am somewhat allergic to the use of all words that end in ism. I think that there are some perfectly good insights to be found in the writings of Marx, but I must confess to a certain allergy to Marxism. I think that there are some perfectly reasonable things that are being said in the social sciences, in the humanities today, in relation to the question of women and the position of women in society. But I must confess that I feel somewhat awkward in the face of something called feminism. Therefore, I have a kind of natural skepticism towards all terms that end in ism, because they convey a sense of something doctrinaire, a fixed position, a fixed ideology, and I feel somewhat reluctant about the use of the term secularism. I would much rather have preferred to speak of a secular orientation. I would have much rather preferred to speak of secular ideas and secular institutions. And I'm going to argue presently why I think both secular ideas and secular institutions are essential to the democratic functioning of our society. When one talks about secularism, when one attaches the ism to the phrase, one sort of conjures up a vision of a totalizing scheme. That is, a point of view which would find space only for secular ideas, only for secular institutions, and exclude everything else. And I don't think that the claim on behalf of secular ideas and secular institutions has to go so far as to demand that all other ideas, all other institutions should be excluded from society. I personally believe that there can be a reasonable point of view which demands that secular ideas must also have a space in society, a point of view which demands that India, as it stands today, has absolute need for a variety of secular institutions. But that demand need not reach to the extent of saying that because we need secular ideas, because we need secular institutions, we should do away with, drive out from society, all ideas and institutions that are not secular. That is a claim which I must say has been characteristic of certain kinds of religious ideologies, a kind of totalizing claim that we must have everything or else we will have nothing. But I think that secular ideas and institutions have generally tried to make more modest claims on their behalf. And therefore, I think the repeated use of the term secularism, and particularly the manner in which the term secularism has been used by its militants and its partisans, has given rise to some unfortunate consequences in our intellectual debates and discussions. So I'm skeptical of secularism as a doctrine, although I believe that this society must find space for secular ideas and secular institutions. And I think much of the attack on secularism is coming now from people who present it as necessarily a kind of doctrine, and besides a doctrine whose proponents seem to be making all kinds of claims on behalf of that doctrine which are mutually inconsistent. I will indicate a few landmarks, papers written by people in my own discipline. I think a very important paper was published in 1985 by a man called Ashish Nandi. It was published in Seminar magazine. It was a long paper of about 30,000 words called An Anti-Secularist Manifesto. And there he took up cudgels against secularism. I don't want to discuss that particular paper, but I think that that was a turning point in the discussion on religion and secularism and Western ideologies and the place of science and all manner of things in our society among social scientists, not only in India, but also outside India, students of Indian society, both in India and outside India. Then in 1987, more or less in the same vein, but in a far less militant tone, a paper was published by one of our most distinguished sociologists, a very careful scholar, a very conscientious scholar, a person by the name of T.N. Madan, who wrote a paper. It was an address, actually, given to the American Association for Asian Studies and published in the Journal of Asian Studies. It was called Secularism in Its Place. That also, I think that that's probably, at least in the United States, among students of Indian society and culture, that has probably been one of the most influential papers by a sociologist in the last 10 years, Secularism in Its Place. Then more recently, in fact, a few months ago, Professor Srinivas, who is our leading student of religion and society, he was a pioneer in the study of religion and society, applying the sociological method and approach, published an article in the Times of India calling for a new philosophy for India, in which he asserted that we should now turn our back on secular humanism. It has failed to deliver the goods, and we should replace it with a new philosophy that will place God as savior at the center of the scheme of things. I have written something much longer. I did write an article in the Times of India after that and another article, but I've written something very much longer for a paper which is to be published shortly, called Secularism and the Intellectuals, in which I have pointed out that what Professor Srinivas urged in that article was somewhat contrary to his own more studied work on the secularization process, which forms a part of one of his most outstanding books published in 1966 called Social Change in Modern India. And I'm happy to say that when I showed the paper to Professor Srinivas earlier this week, He told me that I must publish it immediately and without any delay. So I think that there is a lot of misunderstanding that requires to be cleared up. So I can see that some of the misunderstanding, as I said, arises from the idea that secularism is a kind of militant ideology which wants to drive religion away from society. And not only religious believers, those who are conscientious religious believers, find this repulsive, but also, I think, from the sociological point of view, even from the point of view of a non-believer like myself, from a purely sociological point of view, I think such an idea is fanciful. The idea that in India or in any other society you can have a doctrine which will drive religion completely outside of society is to me a completely fanciful idea, and I don't think that that idea really has much sociological weight or substance. So as I said, secularism, I believe, has to be seen not as being anti-religious, but as being non-religious rather than anti-religious, concentrating on certain ideas and institutions which free themselves from regulation by religious ideas and religious authorities, leaving other ideas and institutions in society that may continue to be regulated by religious ideas and religious authorities. And I would, as I said, I would rather do away with the term secularism altogether. And I have had many discussions on this with T.N. Madan, whose work, Secularism in Its Place, I have quoted. We are next door neighbors, and we discuss these things. And he's an extremely patient, reasonable, and conscientious scholar. And whatever I write and show him, he seems to agree with a great deal of it, even if it has nothing to do with secularism. But as soon as he sees the word secularism, he puts a red pencil under it and says, you know, this word is very confused. It's used in, you'd better avoid using this word. I would have liked to avoid using it, but unfortunately, we are condemned to using it because it has now become a part of our constitution. There is no way in which, I'm myself not absolutely sure whether it was a reasonable thing to put it into our constitution, but there it is, and I don't think that we can possibly expect to avoid discussing a term which occupies a central place in the Constitution of India, and which has in any case become a part of the ordinary language of discussion in Indian society. And I must confess that I'm not altogether convinced by the argument that we should not discuss secularism unless we are able to agree on one single univocal meaning to be attached to the term secularism. Unfortunately, most of the important and seminal concepts and categories used in social science literature are of that kind. It's not simply secularism that has several meanings and that will continue to have several meanings. There are plenty of other concepts that have several meanings and will continue to have several meanings. And I don't think that it would be reasonable to expect us to avoid using the word equality. I have myself spent a lot of time on that particular subject, on the ground that we cannot give one single unequivocal meaning to the concept of equality, that equality of opportunity is quite different from the equal distribution of benefits. And when we are talking about equality, because we cannot give one single unequivocal meaning to that term, therefore we should not discuss it. I'm not saying that we should use terms in an absolutely unlicensed way, but we must recognize that large ideas and concepts like secularism, like equality, like liberty are multivocal by their very nature. And we must be careful in a particular discussion to point out which particular meaning we have in mind without necessarily saying that nobody else has the right to use the term in some other meaning. That's fine, provided he specifies what is the sense in which he is using that particular term. Now, I think that when one discusses secularism, I've given some idea of what are the issues involved in the discussion of secularism today. I think there are two issues that are particularly important and urgent. one issue which requires clarification, I think far more clarification than has been forthcoming, is the issue of, does secularism exclude religion? In a society such as ours, what is to be the relationship between the secular and the religious domains? Can we work out a reasonable approach in which the relationship between the two will be clarified without either party saying that the one should be driven completely outside of society? Because there are now people, not necessarily from the English-speaking intelligentsia, there are people who are arguing that we've had enough with secular institutions. They should, they are not suited to our culture, to our civilization, to our tradition, and therefore we should reconstitute our society in such a way that secular institutions are driven out of this society, just as there have been militants among proponents of secularism who have argued that religion is on the decline, religion is on the way out, and it is best that this decline and disappearance of religion be hastened. Can we have a proper consensus on what is to be the relationship between the religious domain and the secular domain? This, I believe, to be one of the principal issues in the consideration of the debate on secularism today. A second very important issue, and I think that this is very distinctive of India today, is what is to be the role of the state in all of this? What is to be the role of the state in all of this? And this is important because, unlike in other societies, and one can make a comparison with Britain, Britain would be a very good example, ours is a society in which religious elements permeate very many areas of social life and social interaction, including life and interaction in institutions which ought to be considered as secular institutions. Whereas on the other hand, the state is at least in principle a secular state. Whereas in a country like Britain, ordinary social life is far less permeated by religion. But nevertheless, the state is not a secular state. The state of the United Kingdom is not a secular state. It has an established church. The Church of England is an established church. The Archbishop of Canterbury and the other bishops are members ex officio of the House of Lords. The Archbishop of Canterbury is appointed by the Crown. So it is not a secular state. We have a situation in which you have a state which is not a secular state, but where nevertheless society has freed itself in many spheres from regulation by religious ideas and religious authorities. By contrast, we have a society which is permeated to a far greater extent by religious ideas and religious institutions, particularly in our rural areas, where the state has declared itself to be in principle a secular state. Now, that is perfectly acceptable, that the state should declare itself to be in principle a secular state. But how active should the state be in promoting secularism in the different sectors of society? Should it confine itself to giving equal protection to all religions? Or should it take a more active role, either minimizing the place of religion in society, or giving equal encouragement to all religions, to all institutional religions? Now, the problem, I think, has been with a very ambivalent role that the state has taken in Indian society. I think that it is a very, very ambivalent role in relation to religion. It has not really been able to make up its mind as to whether it should adopt a minimalist stance, that is, distance itself, detach itself from religious matters that are internal to society, or whether it should play an active part, take an active role, intervening in religious affairs in order to ensure that all religions are treated equally. There are two completely different ways in which one can think, the state can think, of treating all religions equally. One is by distancing itself equally from all religions, detaching itself, disengaging itself from religious affairs. The other would be to say that the Hindus are not running their temples properly. We should intervene and see that the Hindus run their temples properly, and if this requires some deployment of funds, we should put in funds to ensure that those temples are run properly. And then you find out, well, if you do this for the Hindus, then you must do the same kind of thing for the Muslims. And if you do that for the Hindus and the Muslims, then you must do the same kind of things for the Sikhs. Now, this kind of policy and program has caught the state up in all kinds of difficulties, because it is extremely difficult to ensure that full parity is maintained once you involve yourself more and more in the internal religious affairs of the different religious communities. And I think this has been one of the major problems with the promotion of secularism by the Indian state that has invoked attacks from people like Ashish Nandi and T.N. Madan. And I think to that extent, their attacks are reasonable, if not fully justified. But I think that I have already drawn attention to the fact that the process of secularization, the disengagement of religion from certain spheres of life, from certain institutional domains, and I will give you a concrete example, a concrete historical example of what is meant by this disengagement of religion from certain institutional domains. But I have already given enough indication to say that this disengagement might come about in a number of different ways. It might come about through processes that are internal to society, without any conscious design or any conscious plan for society as a whole, as has happened in the countries of Western Europe. Disengagement of religion from the different institutional domains has come about through the growth of science, through the growth of technology, through the growth of new economic forces, and through the growth of new institutions from which religion, or control of which by religious ideas and authorities, has been excluded. This has come about by a natural process, so to say, and this has been the unintended consequence, one would say, of a variety of different economic and other institutional processes. On the other hand, one may attempt consciously and deliberately to bring about this process of secularization through direct, conscious, and planned intervention. And some of this has certainly happened not only in India, but outside India as well. I think one of the arguments used by both Madan and Srinivas against secularism, and this is a very complex argument, and I think it has many different facets, but one of the arguments that has been used by them is that secularism is the ideology of a minuscule minority of the Indian intelligentsia. Indian intellectuals, academics, bureaucrats, it is their ideology, it is their creation, and it is something that they want to impose on the masses of Indian society, and that secularism is nothing much more beyond that. I personally feel that this argument is not a very reasonable one, that all that there is to secularism is that it is an ideology fabricated by a minuscule minority of intellectuals and then sought to be imposed on the masses of Indian society. I don't find this to be very convincing or plausible, and I will show you why I don't find it to be very convincing and plausible. Certainly that has played some part, but I don't think that it has played such a very important part. But you see, this is an extremely, or can be, an extremely effective way of debunking secularism by saying that it is the creation of a minuscule minority of Western educated intellectuals who are out of tune with the spirit of our culture and civilization, and who are trying to distort the spirit of that culture and that civilization by imposing something which is of their fabrication on the masses of people. because it is only a short step from that to argue that this something that is of their fabrication is not something that they themselves have really created. It is something that they have taken over from the West, and they are trying to impose it on our people. And you know, I must say that this is the part of the argument that makes me feel the most uncomfortable. Because intellectuals in all parts of the world have been vulnerable under critical political conditions to the attack of rootlessness, of being rootless cosmopolitans, of people who have derived ideas from outside, ideas which are not in tune with the spirit of the society as a whole, and ideas which they then try to impose on members of society. I think Ashish Nandi in particular has argued this point of view. It's an attractive idea. I don't think it's a plausible or a reasonable idea. But I must say, and this I would like to insist as strongly as possible, that it is a very attractive idea today. It would not have been an attractive idea in the 50s and the 60s. And this idea, in the case of Ashish Nandi, quite categorically, and also less categorically in the work of T.N. Madan, applies not only to secularism, but also to science and technology, modern science and technology. Modern science and technology are depraving, debasing our traditional culture and civilization, and they are being imposed on us by this same minuscule minority of people. And the argument is a familiar one. It is not raised consistently. When people get fed up with the corruption of parliamentary politics, they say, well, the Westminster system cannot work in India. The Westminster system is alien to our Indian tradition. It has been taken over from somewhere else, and therefore it cannot work. When people get fed up with the waste of money in our scientific research laboratories, then they say, well, what can you expect from them? They are not suited to our tradition and our culture. I find this kind of argument very perverse, but at the same time, it has a quite considerable appeal, and I suspect that this appeal will increase to large masses of people in the course of the years. And therefore, I think it is very essential to understand what are the reasonable parts of the argument being made by these people and what are the unreasonable parts of the argument. Because to me, the whole argument is paradoxical because it denounces as Western and alien a certain point of view in terms of arguments which are developed within identically the same framework. Therefore, if the argument for secularism is an alien argument, the manner in which that argument is being opposed by people like Nandi and people like Madan is no less alien. And I don't think that an institution or an idea in any given society should be judged by any test other than its correspondence with the present requirements of that society. I don't think that we can say reasonably that an idea or an institution is desirable today simply because it has been with us for 2,000 years. If Sati has been with us for 2,000 years, one might say that it has been very much a part of our traditional institutions. If untouchability has been with us for 2,000 years, if child marriage, the prohibition on widow remarriage has been with us for 2,000 years, that is no argument that it should continue to be with us because it doesn't any longer correspond to our present needs and requirements. Likewise, the fact that something, the bicycle was invented somewhere else, is no argument to say that it should not be incorporated in our culture. It does not fit in with our culture. This kind of argument has a certain popular appeal, but I don't think that it is necessarily a reasonable or a convincing argument. But I would now like to turn back on the point. I'd just like to restate the point that secularism is really a product of a certain category of intellectuals which they are trying to impose on the people. I think this is false, and certainly if you look at the the writings of people who have studied religion and society in India over the last 40 years, you will find that the process of secularization has been operating in a number of different ways, in a variety of different ways, outside, completely outside of the control of these intellectuals who are credited with having constructed a coherent ideology and then imposing that ideology on people. Actually, I think one of the best accounts of the secularization process as largely the unintended consequence of a variety of economic and other forces is to be found in the writings of Professor Srinivas himself. There he gives a detailed account of the manner in which the secularization process has been operating in Indian society as a result of a variety of different forces, as a result of, let us say, the expansion of transport and communication, as a result of changes in production technology, as a result of the expansion of markets, as a result of the new legal system, which believes in an impersonal code of law, as a result of the emergence of new administrative structures. All of these, according to him, have operating towards the spread and the progress of secularization in this society. So I think that if secularization has been going on in this society, and I think that there is considerable evidence that it has been going on, it has been only partly due to the conscious activities of constitution makers or lawmakers or intellectuals who write in magazines and journals. It has been going on as a result of a variety of legal, economic, and other forces. But what do we mean by secularization? And I would like here to use the definition proposed by Srinivas himself of what is to be meant by secularization. Srinivas, in 1966, defined the secularization process in terms of two related phenomena. Firstly, he says that secularization means that things that were previously regarded as religious are no longer regarded as such. Mind you, this is not to say that everything that was previously regarded as religious ceases to be regarded as religious. But many of the things, or at least some of the things, that were previously regarded as religious are ceasing to be regarded as religious. And I will give you the various illustrations that he offers, and other illustrations as well, of this process whereby many of the things that were previously regarded as religious are ceasing to be religious. Secondly, the other major aspect of this process is that there are various aspects of society in the economic domain, in the administrative domain, in the political domain, that become progressively discrete and autonomous in relation to religion, and I would add also in relation to the state. New areas, new domains in the economic field, in the political field, in the administrative field emerge that are no longer regulated by religious ideas and religious institutions. Therefore, secularization in the second sense is also a result of the differentiation of societies, the differentiation of societies and the emergence of domains that are relatively autonomous in relation to other domains. These are the two principal aspects of secularization that Srinivas drew our attention to, and I think that this is a good way of describing the process of secularization. And he added that in this sense, secularization is a universal process. But of course, it does not progress evenly in all societies. It does not progress evenly in all sectors of Indian society. In fact, he pointed out that secularization in this sense has progressed much further among the Hindus than among the Muslims, probably. He put forward the argument tentatively and cautiously. In this sense of certain areas, certain practices that were considered to be religious being no longer considered to be religious, and the development of autonomous and discrete spheres or domains of life. Further, it does not progress to the same extent, even among Hindus, in all strata of society. The obvious difference would be between the urban sector and the rural sector. And he pointed out that secularization has progressed much further in urban India than in rural India. And he drew attention to a large number of forces and factors that were moving society in this direction: technology, economic change, and so on and so forth. However, and this is the important point to note, being the good sociologist that he is, he also pointed out that some of these very factors that lead to the advance of secularization also lead to the strengthening of religion. And this is, I think, a very, very important point that we must keep in mind. And therefore, the advance of secularization is by no means a linear process at all. It is a dialectical process. And in that sense, to take one example, railways, transport, it does lead to the breakdown, as Srinivas points out, in certain ideas that were considered to be fundamentally important among the Hindus as religious ideas, like the taboos on purity, pollution, eating, and so on and so forth. But the expansion of railways and transport also leads to an increase in the activities of pilgrimages and pilgrim centers. So many of these new facilities, which have the consequence in some respect of weakening the ties of religion, may also provide facilities for deepening and strengthening religion in a different sense. So it is a very, very complex process, and we must not assume that it moves uniformly in one direction and its net result will be the elimination of religion altogether from our social life. First of all, he points out towards a long-term tendency towards the weakening of the ritual ideas of purity and pollution. This has been a topic on which he has worked over a long period of time, and he has argued with abundant examples that secularization has led to the weakening of the ritual ideas of purity and pollution. And one can find numerous examples. One can just compare the descriptions of Hindu society. I was talking about some of these things when I was lecturing on caste the day before yesterday, the rules of commensality, the restriction on the exchange of food, and a variety of other rules relating to purity and pollution have broken down, are steadily broken down as a result of various economic and other forces. And all of this can be considered to be an advance of secularization. Then, the abbreviation or the attenuation of various kinds of religious activities, particularly two sets of religious activities that have been particularly important to the life of the Hindus. And in all societies, they're important. One is what one would describe as the life cycle ceremonies. The life cycle ceremonies, the ceremonies on occasions of birth, marriage, and death. And certainly among upper caste Hindus, the number of these ceremonies, particularly among the Brahmins, was very large. Some of these tend to get dropped altogether, like the ear-boring ceremony for boys, and so on. The wearing of the sacred thread that either tends to get dropped or tends to be greatly abbreviated. And further, several of these ceremonies, particularly marriage, which is one of the most important of these ceremonies, it tends to get redefined as a social rather than a religious occasion. It does not cease to be a religious occasion. Its religious components do not disappear altogether, but it gets redefined, and the social components now acquire a more significant space than the religious components. Similarly, for the calendric festivals, the festivals of the annual cycle, and I have myself seen this transformation from my boyhood to my adulthood in the nature of Durga Puja in Calcutta. I mean, if you read the accounts of Durga Puja in the 19th century, you'll be struck by two things. First of all, that Durga Puja in Calcutta is celebrated on a much larger scale in the 20th century, even over the last 20 years, despite the fact that there is a CPM government. And members of the left parties, including very committed left intellectuals, take a very active part in the organization of Durga Puja. And if you ask them how they can reconcile this with their Marxist ideology, they will tell you, well, it's a social occasion. It's not really a religious occasion. I'm not saying that by being called a social occasion, it ceases to be a religious occasion, but it gets redefined to some extent. I'm not saying that by being redefined as a social occasion, marriage ceases to be a religious occasion, but it does tend to get redefined to some extent. So many of the ritual aspects of life tend to get dropped, and many occasions that were considered in the past as primarily religious occasions tend to get redefined as being partly, at least, social rather than religious occasions. Now, what does all this mean for religion? This is secularization. What does all this mean for religion? Does it mean that there is a continuing trend towards the decline of religion? Yes and no, I would say. And this is a point that has not been made by any of our students of secularization. Why do I say yes and no? I say yes and no because it depends on what you mean by religion. What you mean by religion. Any sociologist of religion, and there have been a fairly large number of sociologists of religion, has to deal with the distinction, this is a central topic in the sociology of religion, the distinction between magic and religion. Now, don't ask me to give you an exact, clear, consistent distinction between magic and religion, but there is such a distinction. You have to take me at my word, because this is a subject which the discipline has developed over the last 70 or 80 years. Every single major sociologist of religion who has written on the subject, whether it's Emil Durkheim or Max Weber or Malinowski or Radcliffe Brown, has struggled with the need to find a consistent way of distinguishing between magic and religion. So let us assume that such a distinction can be made, even though we cannot make it in terms of an exact formula. Now, if we make that assumption, then we will be bound to recognize the fact that all great world religions have a large number of magical components, a large number of components that belong really to the domain of magic rather than to the domain of religion. And probably this is more true of some of the great world religions than of the others. Certainly, this was more true of Catholicism than of ascetic Protestantism. And probably it is more true of Hinduism than of Islam. Now one can certainly argue, that yes, ideas relating to purity and pollution are dropping out of Hinduism. In the past, a woman in her periods would not be allowed to enter the kitchen. Now she is allowed to enter the kitchen. In the past, an untouchable would not be allowed to even come near a temple. Now he is allowed to enter the temple. Some restrictions are being dropped. But do these restrictions really relate? Are they a part of Hindu religion or are they a part of Hindu magic? I think that someone like Vivekananda, for instance, might certainly agree that all of this is happening, but all of this need not necessarily weaken Hindu religion in the proper sense of the term. Hindu religion in the proper sense of the term is concerned with salvation, is concerned with one's relation to God through the use of certain sacred rites and sacred symbols. It does not necessarily mean that it has to carry with it this whole baggage of ritual practices relating to purity and pollution. It can drop some of that baggage. And if it drops some of that baggage, that may not in fact lead to a weakening of Hindu religion. It may in fact lead to a strengthening of Hindu religion. Because some might say, what is religion? How is the strength of a religion to be judged? The strength of a religion may not be judged simply in terms of its spread and its extent and its reach into every domain of life. It could also be judged in terms of the intensity of belief, faith, devotion. If one takes that view, then I think much of what is presented as a conflict between religion and the secular orientation may in fact appear in a different light. I'm not saying that by doing that, all the conflict disappears. In fact, this is how religion often reforms
and changes itself, and in some respects at least, though not in every respect, secularization may turn out to be an ally of religion defined in a certain way. There's a very famous, one of the great English historians called Keith Thomas, who has a fat book of about 700 pages called Religion and the Decline of Magic. Now, this relates to early modern England, where he argues that Catholicism is encrusted with a variety of different practices, which even Catholic theologians themselves would admit are a part of popular religion, but they are not exactly essential to Catholic religion. We do not touch all these things because this is how the people believe, this is how the people live. And then comes Protestantism, and it weeds out many of these magical elements. And as a result of that, there is a counter-reformation, not just a reformation, a counter-reformation, which leads the Catholic Church itself to re-examine many of its components, which had been considered as essential parts of Catholic belief and practice, so that you have a new kind of Catholic religion. Now, these are considerations which I think are extremely important. I'm not saying that, you know, that there is no possibility of any conflict between secular ideas and institutions and religion redefined in this sense. There still will be problems of how the domain and how the terrain of the two is defined and redefined. But I think that it is important to keep this particular point in mind. I now turn to the other side of secularization as Srinivas had defined it, namely secularization as the differentiation of society. That in the past, if you go to a tribal village, for instance, you will find religion, politics, economics, kinship, all mixed together. There are no separate religious institutions, economic institutions, political institutions. All sociologists have agreed, following the biologists, that the process of evolution, whether in the individual animal organism or in human society as a whole, the process of evolution is nothing but a process of differentiation, a process whereby we move from the simple to the complex, from the homogeneous to the heterogeneous, from the less differentiated to the more differentiated. And this process of differentiation therefore leads to the emergence of many different kinds of institutions, each occupying a certain space and having a certain set of principles by which it is governed, and not governed by a general set of principles. So this simply means that religion, religious institutions, do not cease to exist, but their domain is marked out, and within that domain they are supreme. Academic institutions, and I must say this, that if you take the universities of the West, you can see how this process of differentiation occurred. If you take the universities of the West, and it's true that we had universities in the past, in the distant past, but our present universities, and let me say a few words in support of our present universities, although they are in a very, very sorry state today. As a university man, I would like to be loyal to the institution which I serve. Our present universities, in fact, are derived from the model of the Western universities. We have adapted them to our own requirements, but if you look at the model of the Western university, you will see the slow and gradual process whereby it differentiates itself as a predominantly academic institution from the church. I mean, the old colleges in Cambridge, Oxford, Paris, they were in fact set up by monastic orders, and they were permeated, animated by religious ideas, and they were regulated by religious authority. Make no mistake about that. You take the case of Newton, for instance. And I'm now talking about the 17th century, not about the 13th or the 14th century, when the universities in Cambridge and Oxford were completely regulated by the church. When there was, you know, there were church services, every college in Cambridge even now has a chapel, a church services there. And thought was regulated by religious authorities.
There's a famous case, and there are thousands of such cases, but there is a famous case of Newton. Newton is known to the world at large as simply a man who made spectacular discoveries in optics, in gravitation, in the differential calculus, and so on and so forth. But probably the interest that was closest to Newton's heart when he was in Trinity College, Cambridge, was alchemy. You know, all kinds of trying to find the secret of gold, trying to find... He spent endless hours in his room, locked up, performing experiments, which were really of a magical nature. But he lived in absolute fear and terror lest anybody should find out what he was doing. Because if this was reported to the church authorities, to the religious authorities of Cambridge, he would certainly be dismissed from his fellowship and from his chair. Gradually, this has differentiated itself as an autonomous sphere in which one can pursue various branches of learning. In Paris, the queen of the faculties in the University of Paris when it was set up was the Faculty of Theology. The most important faculty in Oxford when it was set up was the Faculty of Theology. And that exercised a predominant influence in the whole of teaching in Paris or in Oxford. Well, there is still a Regius Professor of Theology in Oxford, but it does not regulate the whole of life there. And this has been a slow and a very gradual process. But even now, the universities in Oxford, Cambridge, and in most European countries have religious functionaries on their payrolls. They continue to have religious functionaries on their payrolls. But they now perform a very, very limited function. And this would be unthinkable in our universities to have religious functionaries on the payrolls. In England, in Oxford and Cambridge, in my discipline, anthropology and sociology, the leading figures, the creators of anthropology and sociology, E.B. Tyler in the case of anthropology, Herbert Spencer in the case of sociology, could not enter university. They did not have a university education. And why was that so? That was for a religious reason. Because in England, when they were young, there were only two universities, Cambridge and Oxford. And London had come up and Durham had come up, but still. And the rule was that you were required to subscribe to the 39 Articles of the Church of England. And they were both dissenters. One was a Quaker, Tyler, and so they were not, Jews would not be admitted. You would not be admitted even if you belonged to a dissenting branch of the Christian church. You had to subscribe to the art. All of that has completely disappeared, and this has disappeared over a slow and a gradual process of time. Now, I think that the universities have benefited very largely as a result of this disappearance, and I don't see today how our universities could function as proper universities if they were not freed from regulation by religious ideas and authorities. And it is not just a question of universities. One can think of a whole array of modern institutions, universities, scientific research laboratories, hospitals, banks. All of these require to be governed by their own rules and principles and to be relatively free from regulation by religious ideas and institutions. And in a sense, it is this process that I regard as being of fundamental importance to the process of secularization. And if one really attaches oneself to the idea of secular values, secular institutions, it is primarily this kind of thing that makes that attachment necessary and not just desirable. So what would this mean in the end? This would mean that from my point of view, from the point of view of a secular intellectual, the commitment is to a kind of society that will find space for a variety of differentiated institutions, universities, colleges, research laboratories, hospitals, banks, and various other kinds of institutions that will be called secular institutions. They are secular institutions in the sense that they are not regulated by religious ideas or religious institutions. However, the same society will also have space for distinctively religious institutions, which are not necessarily governed by considerations that are predominant in the National Physical Laboratory or the National Chemical Laboratory, because their concerns are completely different. So there will be, in addition to these secular institutions, there will be religious institutions, temples, mosques, gurdwaras. And indeed, I find it very difficult to conceive of a society which will not have any religious institutions. That kind of attempt was made in the Soviet Union and in China, and in both cases, it has proved to be a costly folly. That if you feel that human beings in society, ordinary human beings in society, can go through birth and death, suffering and healing, pain and regeneration, without some solace from institutions of the kind which they have devised over a long period of time, I think it is a very serious mistake to make. So I think that there will be secular institutions, there will be religious institutions, and there will be, in addition, other institutions which are not clearly either secular or religion, such as the family, for instance. I don't think of the family as being necessarily either a secular institution or a religious institution. It is simply an institution of its own kind. And I do not see what the difficulty or the problem is for the individual in being committed both to a religious institution and to a secular institution. Let me give you an example of what I mean. I am a professor in the Delhi School of Economics. And my work in the Delhi School of Economics is a very important part of my life. When I work in the Delhi School of Economics, considerations of family and kinship do not enter into my work, or at least should not enter into my work. I should not, if a cousin or a nephew or a sister-in-law comes, and I should not take that into account in dealing with her as a student or as a colleague. But what does that mean? Does that mean that I have no attachment whatsoever to my family or to my kin group? It doesn't mean that at all. It means that I express that attachment not in the sphere of my work, which is a different sphere altogether, but in another sphere, in the sphere, in my domestic sphere, in the sphere of the family. Likewise, the fact that when I work in the Delhi School of Economics or in a hospital, if I work in a hospital, if I'm a doctor in a hospital, a secular hospital means that I will take in patients irrespective of their religious belief or their religious practice. I should not really ask a patient who needs my attention, is he a Hindu, is he a Muslim, is he a Sikh? I should not deal with my colleagues, my seniors, and my subordinates in terms of my religious affiliation. But that does not mean that when I want to get my daughter married, I am not free to decide if I'm a Muslim that I will see that she marries a Muslim boy. That does not mean that I am not free to undertake Friday prayers. That does not mean that I am not free to come to my own terms with my God in the way in which I conceive of that God. It only means that there are spheres into which these considerations need not enter. And I say that this is the true secular point of view, but I am also saying that this point of view is not altogether unknown to the great religious traditions either. Today what has happened is that the differentiation of society makes the claims of these institutions much more urgent, much more compelling than in the past, although this point of view was perfectly well understood in several religious traditions, certainly in the Christian tradition, where in the Gospel according to Matthew, Christ himself says, "Render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." So I really do not see. Now, of course, there are all kinds of problems here, because who is to decide which things are the things that are Caesar's and which things are the things that are God's? I don't think that the problem is solved by accepting in principle that there has to be some differentiation. I don't think the problem is solved. But I think that we do take a major step forward when we accept the fact that there are things which can be legitimately developed, cultivated, independently of regulation by religious ideas and religious beliefs. And there are other things that can be legitimately given a place independently of regulation by secular or scientific or whatever ideas you wish to call. I think a considerable step is taken, and then a dialogue becomes possible, because society always changes. It doesn't remain
It doesn't remain at a standstill at any point of time. So which institutions will be regulated in which ways, how all of this is going to be worked out, this is not given in the formula, render unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. But I nevertheless believe that a recognition of this principle is absolutely essential to living in a society that must find space for both religious and secular institutions. Thank you.